Grief is the conversation that no one wants, but everyone will need at some point in their life. Losing my youngest son, Murray, in 2019, as he had just turned 22 years old, has been and is the single most challenging thing I have ever faced. And the guests on the Good Grief Conversation help me with that challenge every day, and they make the journey just that little bit easier. I hope that the open and honest conversation you will hear will help you too. Welcome to the Good Grief Conversation, here on UK Health Radio. I'm your host, Janet Jones. And welcome back to the Good Grief Conversation, and welcome to 2021. Wow, a brand new year. And I have a really great guest to start this year off with. It's very inspirational and filled with joy. And my guest is Suzanne Falter. Suzanne is an author and a speaker, and an author of both fiction and non-fiction books. And one of the books that really helped me along my journey was her book called Surrendering to Joy, and we're going to talk quite deeply about that book, Surrendering to Joy, and what that means in terms of grief. You see, Suzanne lost her daughter Teal when Teal was just 22, but Teal was a very special spirit, and she changed Suzanne's life drastically and brought joy into Suzanne's life after she had passed away. Now, you would think that probably wouldn't be possible, to lose your daughter and then feel joy, but she did. So here is Suzanne to start off 2021 in a really positive and joyful way. So Suzanne, thank you very much for giving us the time to come into the Good Grief Conversation.
I am delighted to be here. Thank you, Janet.
Thank you. Now, we have a mutual friend, a lovely Nikki Pattinson, who was one of my guests right at the beginning of this program. And I know when I lost Murray, she contacted you and you sent me your brilliant book, Surrendering to Joy. So I just want to start this conversation out with reading a little bit from Amazon about your book. It says, "This is a story of letting go, dancing through a dark tunnel, fumbling along from one signpost to the next, and believing for no good reason that at any moment an unexpected light will shine. Of course, the light was always there from the beginning, shining quite beautifully. I'd simply forgotten where to look for it. So I find myself with nothing to call my own in my 53rd year. This was the year I lost everything. My career, my home, the relationship I had been pinning my hopes on, my mother, and my marriage of 23 years. And then I lost Teal." And of course, Teal is your daughter. Usually I have conversations talking about loss around people losing their home, another conversation about losing a relationship, but actually you've lost everything that is possible to lose. At some point, you've lost that. But yet you can still write a book about joy. In fact, several books about joy. I know this is only one of them. How'd you do that?
Yeah, well, I had written a book about joy back in mid-90s called How Much Joy Can You Stand? That was very successful at the time. And it kind of got me on this roll, and my publisher wanted another book. So I wrote Living Your Joy, and I was almost joy, right? But at the time, Janet, I really thought joy was about accomplishment and doing things. And of course, in the 90s, I was in my 30s and I was still a gung-ho girl. And I was all about, you know, making everything happen so I could be as productive and successful as possible. Then I went through this description you just read, which was in my early 50s, really. And I found out that joy is not about what you do. It's about who you are and how you express yourself. It's about a state of being. I had no idea when my daughter died how to get back to that state of being, because my personal belief is that we're all grounded in joy in various ways. We're born joyful. We cry when we're needing the new diaper or nappy, or we cry when we need our formula, or we cry when we have gassy tummies as little babies. But most of the time, we're pretty happy little campers, and we're just delighted by the world. And that is our natural state. And we work our way out of that as we become older and more mature, and we start to internalize all these messages from the world. And maybe we take some bullying, and maybe we take some abuse, and pretty soon we're pretty miserable. And by the time Teal died in August of 2012, I had been out of this relationship for about 3 months. And it had been a very, very difficult relationship with a lot of abuse in it. I was just really hurting. And my business was a business that had really taken off, but it wasn't the work of my soul. It was something I was good at, but it was not something I was grounded in. And I found that I had lost my way and that my values had become corrupted by a desire to be powerful or wealthy. You know, I'd forgotten about what I really, really cared about, which was love and understanding and connection between people. And these were all lessons that my daughter Teal embodied very beautifully. And after her death, she died from a cardiac arrest, actually, from which she was revived, but she never came out of the coma that was a result of that. And she died 6 days later. And her desire was to be a healer. And her practice was to take her little guitar and her savings from working as a waitress and go around the world and meet people and sing for them on the street. It couldn't be simpler. And her notebooks and journals she left behind often had this little phrase in them that said, just be, just be. And that's what I didn't know how to do. I'd forgotten.
Because the society gives us this picture of success and happiness of what it should be. And actually, what it is, you probably can't really capture it in an image because it's about being as opposed to owning something. And I know that in your book, you talk about the unified field of love. Let's talk about that, because I love that. And I love at the time that it came to you, because it was, well, in the book, you say you were sitting next to Teal at the time.
Yes. Well, she was in the hospital in a coma for 6 days, as I mentioned, and she was on life support, and they were trying to keep her alive and assess the degree of damage in her brain. So she was just in this very inert state. And while I was sitting with her, I had a lot of connection to something I can't really even define. And there was this one day where I was alone with her, and I felt this deep spiritual sort of rush from her body into my body. That's really, as you put it, it's kind of beyond words. It's not something that's easy to articulate what actually happened. But I felt very shifted by it. And I felt deeply connected to other people. And I felt this little phrase, the unified field of love, pop into my head. And I felt that was some sort of explanation for what I was experiencing. And shortly after that, I was given the opportunity to take a little break. My former husband and my son came in and they were going to sit with her for a while. So I took a little walk around the hospital that she was in. And I saw all these people. I saw nurses and med students and homeless people and huge immigrant families and, you know, all sorts of people, every race, color, gender, everything in this big public hospital in San Francisco. And as I looked at them, I could feel everyone's pain. I could feel everyone's joy. I could feel their worry. I could feel their concern. I could feel what they were feeling. And the only other time I experienced this was the day Teal was born. And I actually don't share this story very often because I don't make the connection in my own mind as I'm speaking about it. But the day she was born, I was given a 24-hour time release shot of morphine, and morphine can make strange things happen, right? Turned out I was very allergic to the morphine, so I was having a rough time with it. But in that period, while I was so high on morphine, every time the nurse came in the room, I could see an aura around her and I could read all of her thoughts. And I knew everything that was going on with these nurses. And it wasn't pretty. Some of them were having a very hard time at home. And I was sort of like out of it, right? Because I was all stoned on morphine. But I recognize now that this had to do with Teal and Teal's deep interconnection with other people. And later that week of that 6 days, we determined that we were going to have to take her off life support, that her brain injuries were too great to survive. We were asked if we would donate her organs, and we said yes. So the amazing thing is that a young woman her age got her heart and her kidney. And I did not meet this young woman till 5 years later, when we were finally had processed this enough that we could do this. It saved her life. My wife and I met her and her mom on the beach where we had scattered Teal's ashes. And her mother was just instantly somebody I connected with. She was an amazing, is an amazing young woman who works in a hospital and has carried on and really made something wonderful out of her career. And her mother is this fun, resilient, joyful woman who has become one of my really dear friends, with whom I actually do a podcast. Yeah, we're really connected to each other. And when Teal's heart was given to this young woman, Amara, and she was in recovery, having just gotten this heart after 8 years of congestive heart failure, nearly dying numerous times, Debbie, her mom, walked in her room and she saw a sparkling glow all around her body. I had woken up 3 days earlier feeling Teal around me while she was in this coma, and her energy was effervescent and luminous and sparkling. And here it was in Amara's body. And just to confirm this, her sister walked in the room after her, looked at Amara and said, "Oh, she's glowing."
Wow. Wow. You blow me away, Suzanne. That's so visual that you have experienced, not only described it, it was this visual experience. Gosh, it's very comforting, isn't it?
That's the unified field of love right there.
Now, well, maybe the gift comes immediately, but we're not ready for it immediately.
I think so. And Janet, when I got the message about the unified field of love, the big thing I took away, and I really sensed this even before that day, the night Teal was taken into the hospital, the minute I saw her laid out on this hospital bed, and this was 2 hours after we'd had dinner together, I looked at her and I knew everything would change. I knew she would die. I knew I would become the healer that she wanted to be, that it would be my job to spread that light and that happiness, and that I would have to dramatically change how I was living my life. And that's the gift of grief. That's the gift of loss, you know, right there.
I remember reading your book. I was in the dark stage, you know, that bit where it's heavy and it's you don't know whether you're going to survive it or not. But I still read your book and I could see the possibilities in it, but I didn't feel I was ready for it at that time. But just having read it, you gave me the hope that I would make it through that dark tunnel. Now, I'd never say that I'd make it through grief, because I don't think there's a through grief. I think it just changes you. But you can get through the dark, the really dark, heavy, lonely place. And that's what your book did for me. You know, amongst many, I mean, I became a crazy reader. I know some people go, "I can't read at that time. You know, my mind can't concentrate." But I was devouring book after book. I think it's a reaching out just to say, somebody in the know, tell me, I will continue to live, not just survive, but live. Because that's the important bit, isn't it? Is to go on and live.
Not only to live, but to really get to enjoy the life that your child didn't fully get. I mean, I say that, but Teal packed so much into 22 years.
Well, as did Murray.
When I wrote her obituary, I was like, God, did we do that much when we were 22? You know, I'm sure.
I know, it's brilliant. As you saw my little, sort of little markers in your book there. And I know we're not going to get through all of this, but we will go into the podcast extras and carry on chatting. But there's this thing about returning to bliss. So it's in the chapter, Returning to Bliss. And again, when you're in this dark place or an uncomfortable place, there's a paragraph that stood out to me. You put, our logical minds want so badly to make sense of this old world. How we desperately want to navigate our way through uncertainty, imagining untold conversations and fixing our sights on certain outcomes. And yet there is no certainty to be had ever under any circumstances. Now, that's a scary paragraph, but one that explains so much. So let's talk some more about that.
Well, I'm listening to that and I'm thinking, well, you can say that blithely, you know. But at the time, I had to tell myself that because, Janet, I was clinging with my fingernails bloody and bruised, hanging on for dear life, needing to convince myself of everything I was writing. I'm no paragon of virtue, you know. And fact is that at that time, going through a period where I really didn't know how I was going to make money, but I had some money in the bank. I had gotten a divorce settlement and I had savings and I was going to be okay for a year. And then my mother passed away at age 94. You know, it was really her time. It was a much more expected and appropriate death in some ways in Teal's. And I received a little money from her. So I didn't have to work for 2 years if I lived extremely frugally, which I did. I lived in a friend's guest room, basically, for free, which really made it possible to be extremely frugal in California. But the return to bliss was about trying to accept the fact that uncertainty is so huge and unavoidable. And at that time, I had given up a career as an internet marketing consultant, which had been very lucrative. So I kept thinking, well, if and when I can pull myself off the floor, I can do that again if I have to, even though I resisted it with every fiber of my being. So finally, 2 years later, I got to the point where I was launching my first program since Teal's death, pretty much. And it was a successful program I had launched in the past. I was just going to do another launch. It was already online. It was already built. It was already there. No problem. So I looked at it, I was like, let me tweak it. Let me make it better. Let me redo some of this technical back office stuff. And I rebuilt it. And the day it launched, a bunch of people bought it. There was going to be good income coming in from it. I was so relieved. And then immediately the site where all the lessons were loaded crashed. And this is before Thinkific. So it was like my own little learning platform, basically. Ad died, that crashed, and a hacker had found their way into it and taken the whole thing down. And my web person kept putting it back up online and the hacker kept taking it down, and they did it 5 times to the point where my assistant had malware deposited into her computer that ate her entire hard drive. The universe was like, you may think you're going to go back to running this business, but you will not. And I surrendered. I said, okay, I won't do it. And I don't know how I'm going to make a living. And I'm just going to have to be with that. And I am okay. I have money. I'm okay. I've got supportive friends. I'll be fine. So then I had to live with this idea of I don't know who I am or I don't know what I'm doing. And a very critical thing happened to me one afternoon while I was sitting in my office. And I was just despairing. I was sitting on my little chaise and I just felt so sad and so bewildered. And I just didn't know where to go or what to do. And I felt I heard Teal whispering in my ear saying, clean out your inbox. And she's talking about a physical inbox. I had a wire basket loaded with, you know, a huge pile of papers in it. And I was like, really? Seriously? And I had taken this thing, Janet, I'd moved 5 times in 2 years, and I had taken this thing from house to house where I was staying, and I'd never cleaned it out. I'd never done anything with it. So that afternoon, I cleaned out my inbox. And I got to the very bottom. There was maybe 1 or 2 pieces of paper left. And I didn't find anything significant. And I'm like, I turn over the last piece of paper. It was a letter from Teal, and she had written it to me about 8 months before she died. And in it, she described an encounter she'd had with a healer who had told her that she and I were meant to be leaders in light together, and that she would support any light leadership I had to bring to the world. And here I was trying to figure out, what am I supposed to do with myself? And this great confirmation came to me, which was open up, wait, receive, you'll know what to do. Teal is helping you.
Amazing, isn't it? Because sometimes, you know, you hear these sort of little voices in your head and instructions, and then you think, that's just me talking to myself. But maybe it isn't. But that is so strange that that led you to that letter, which then changed your life then. That was your turnaround, wasn't it?
Well, it really was, because not long after that, I got a call from the people who had arranged Teal's organ transplant, who, you know, they do reach out to the donor families periodically during the year after the death, and they let you know how the person or people are doing who've received the organs, and they want to make sure you're doing okay, and they offer you support and such. And by this point, we were chatting, and I said, I would love to be able to help your organization somehow. And she said, are you a speaker? And I said, well, how funny. Why should you ask me that? Because, in fact, I am a speaker, and I have been a speaker for many years. And she said, I don't know why I asked you that. I said, I am a speaker. And she said, we need you. So I ended up speaking at several conferences as the keynoter on my experience as a donor mother, which apparently there aren't a lot of donor people out there in the world willing to talk about their experiences. And the people who do these transplants, from the doctors down to the people who drive the organs across the city, they have extreme pressure because they make mistakes. You know, the recipient could die waiting for the organ that is not fast enough or not viable enough, you know. So, you know, it's been a great opportunity. And now I actually do those talks with Debbie, the mother of Teal's heart recipient.
It is a lovely thing to do. But at that time, you know, how did you feel knowing that you're going to be taking parts of Teal away from Teal?
Well, I always came from an ashes to ashes, dust to dust perspective, you know. So we thought, well, of course we should do that. And particularly because Teal wanted to be a healer. Here's the interesting thing about that. Her brother wasn't so sure. Her younger brother, Luke, who was 18 at the time, is a very scientific and analytical thinker. And we spent a few hours talking to him along with nurses and the organ donation folks, and really explaining exactly what would happen. We learned all about it. And then he agreed, and he decided it would be a good thing, but only because he had been able to look at it from every possible perspective. And today, what do you think his work is?
Does he work in transplants?
He's an autopsy technician. Isn't that extraordinary?
Isn't that extraordinary?
And he has really been very fascinated by that work. You know, you'd never think a morgue would be like a great place to work. But if you're fascinated with the human body and anatomy, which he is, and you learn a lot about, you know, forensics and sometimes criminal justice and so forth.
And it's more than that as well, though, isn't it? Because it's giving someone else life. It's giving someone else a second chance. And also it's giving Teal a second chance, too.
Exactly. That's how we looked at it. Was like, well, why wouldn't we want to keep precious pieces of this incredible person alive? And, you know, Debbie is so grateful, and I'm so grateful. And we spent like the first year of our friendship talking and sobbing and talking and sobbing and talking. We just cried all the time together. And now we laugh about it if we cry together. And we do sometimes still to this day.
Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that. People seem to think that, oh, if you're crying, it's showing, you know, some kind of weakness or something, or that you're not healed or you still have a problem. And that doesn't seem right to me. There are tears in life of both joy and sadness. And why don't we just accept them?
Well, I think when we go through this experience that we've both been through, you are taken to the bottom of all human experience, basically, along with a number of other hard, difficult losses people can experience. And when you get to that level of loss and you look at the edge of life and you kind of look over the edge and you see infinity and beyond, you know, you realize well, okay, I got there. I can get back. I'm going to do this. It's all going to be fine. And everything has new perspective. I really noticed the things that I used to worry about so much, meaningless. The things I used to fear, I found, Janet, and perhaps you found this, I really don't have a big fear of death anymore.
I don't like pain. I don't like the idea.
Yeah, no, I'm not up for pain.
But if I went to sleep and that was that, that would be fine. You know, not today because there's stuff I want to do. But then, hey, I'm probably not the one who's choosing that date anyway. But yeah, I agree. And that also comes, even though I've lost my mom and I've lost my dad. I say lost, you know what I mean. They're not physically here. But somehow, when it happened to Murray, I just thought, well, if Murray can do it, so can I. And that then gives me the confidence that that's going to be fine. So therefore, what else is there to worry about in life? Nothing, because most people's worries come down to death. You know, when you chunk it all down. So once you resonate with that aspect of life, then you can get on and live your life.
And you had mentioned tears. And I think at the beginning of my grief, I gave myself full permission to cry whenever, wherever, however, and put Kleenex, you know, or tissues everywhere in my life, in my car, in my office, and, you know, wherever I was, I just had tissues with me. And I cried a lot. And I really think that was meant to be very healing. And I later met a photographer who shoots photo micrography of tears, which are extreme magnifications of tears. And she said the tears people cry when they're grieving are a different structure than the tears people cry when they're angry or when they're afraid or even when they're happy. Tears of joy, you know, she said they all look different. And that they're presumably designed differently to help us cope with these different emotional experiences.
But you know, it's funny you saying you had tissues and Kleenex everywhere. Do you know what? I didn't use them at all because I cried so much, so often, it would just run down my face and I'd just wipe them away. And I'd say, do you know what? It doesn't matter. And I didn't wear any mascara. Well, I've only just started putting it on and I'm nearly 18 months behind. And even then, I'm not bothered. I always put my lipstick on, but I've always put my lipstick on.
Well, I'm impressed you're wearing makeup.
Only lipstick. I don't wear anything else.
I've become like a makeup phobe in my older years.
Well, it's funny. Before Murray's accident, I would always put all my makeup on, all eyeshadow, you know, everything. And I had to present myself well. And I used to paint my fingernails. I haven't put nail varnish since. And I just think, why did I even spend time doing that? It's like time suddenly becomes precious. And you realize when you stop doing those things that really are to impress someone else, you get so much of your life back.
Till was extremely simple with all that sort of thing. And at the end of her life, she just sort of went around in a sweatshirt and a pair of jeans and these little sneakers with some little holes in the toes. And I kind of took my cue from her about simplicity because I realized she gave away, like 2 months before her death, she went through her old childhood bedroom and gave all her stuff away. And all she left behind was a little collection of things that sort of told the story of her life that were arranged in a bookcase. And it was very clear to me that on some subconscious level, she knew her life was going to end.
And you know, the other thing that I find interesting is that, you know, friends who now, new friends who I know who have lost children, they all say one key thing, and that their child packed so much into those short number of years and what a big personality they were and their presence. And I'm just like, that's bizarre, isn't it? And then they describe them as an old soul. And I've always described Murray as an old soul. And even as a child, I used to say to him, you know, just relax, son. You'll be brilliant as an adult, always. And then he only got to be an adult for a short period of time, but he was brilliant as an adult. But he was old beyond his years. There's another thing that I read, got from your book, is about this change in perspective. And we touched on that earlier. I mean, we've said, you know, makeup, that's gone. But then how did you live after that? You know, you followed this passion as opposed to what's expected. But what did it do to you on a deeper level?
Well, I think the big lesson was learning to live with the unknown and becoming much more present in my own life and not worrying as much. And I was just a huge worrier all through my childhood. My fourth grade teacher, Miss Brown, wrote down on my report card, "Suzanne worries excessively." Even as a child, I had anxiety. And I honestly think it was what we were talking about a few minutes ago, that when you get to the bottom and you get through it, everything's okay. And you know everything's going to be okay. For me, a big discovery was self-care and finding my way to really learning about self-care. Because I was a workaholic, Janet. That was why my business ended. It was just kind of something I did 24/7 and it burned me out. What I cared about was the people. I loved the people. They were great that I worked with. But I didn't want to be their marketing consultant. And at the end of it, I was able to let it go. But then there was just this big question, you know, well, what are my values? What do I care about? I think what I really discovered is I care about being a really good person in this world and giving back and treating people with love and respect and treating myself with love and respect. So for 2 years, I ended up taking really, really extremely good care of myself. And I stopped being a workaholic. I got my money together. I got my goals and my vision were amorphous, but I accepted that. I got my body in great shape. I stayed as present as I could, and I kept my focus on doing the next right thing. And I learned a lot about setting boundaries and making requests and getting clear on what I needed and wanted, because I'd been so busy taking care of everybody else that that's what burned me out.
And that's quite a woman thing, isn't it? You know, we're always so busy taking care of everyone else and don't take care of ourselves. Nothing happens overnight. You don't go from, you know, 1 minute you're taking care of everyone else. And even in grief as a woman, you're always looking out for other people, even at the time when you have virtually nothing to give anyone. You take what you've got to give and you give it to someone else.
Well, it helped that I was not actively a mother. I was in California alone when Teal died. And my son was back east and he was in college and he was busy with his life. And I had been in a relationship but that ended. So I really was alone for 2 years. I just naturally gravitated towards self-care and then teaching people about self-care, mostly in my blog for a long time. And then I was approached to do a book and I did the book about it, The Extremely Busy Woman's Guide to Self-Care. Writing that book was great because I had been teaching self-care workshops to the organ procurement community, the people who arrange the organ transplants. So I put it all together in a book for extremely busy women, and that's really done well. And the extremely busy women I hear from all the time, and I have a Facebook group where they hang out and talk to each other, and it's a great group. It's such a lovely group for anybody who's needing a little extra self-care support, because we come in and people say things like, I just took a long hot bath for an hour and nobody bothered me. You know, there's a lot of people with small children in this group who are just desperate for a little alone time, you know, and who can blame them?
Absolutely. At the beginning of this, I didn't see that I was fortunate that I was on my own. I mean, and I really was on my own. I was in the home on my own. I didn't have friends around. And of course, you know, we've spent nearly all this year in lockdown. And as traumatic as that was right at the beginning, what it did was it brought me face to face to the grief. For me, it was about leaning into the pain. Would you say you went on that journey and you leaned into the pain, or did you find that, you know, this connection that you had right at the beginning about the unified field of love, that somehow lifted the pain, or, you know, what was that bit like?
Those are good questions. Well, I'll tell you, Janet, I felt, because Teal's death was so sudden and completely unexpected, I mean, 2 hours after we had dinner, there she was in critical condition. So I spent the first year really trying to believe that she had died. I couldn't even believe it. And I kept wanting to call her and picking up the phone, you know, and I hear this from other people who've experienced sudden deaths. The second year was when it really hit me. And the first year, I also was really feeling very connected to her on the other side, and perhaps even was, you know. the second year that began to lift a little, and I had the opportunity to really melt down and totally cry out my tears. And I gave myself a lot of time, which is not to say I didn't have sad, very dark times in that first year, because I certainly did. 4 years after her death, by then I was married to the woman who's now my wife. And, you know, my whole life really changed. And I was also now doing work. I have an investor who pays me to write fiction. And I'm also a novelist. So that's been a great source of income for me. And also a chance to do something that I really love, as well as nonfiction, which is to write novels. So, you know, the whole thing kind of naturally morphed and changed, but it took time and it took a huge amount of letting go, which is why I've written about it so much. And of course, self-care.
Yeah, and you do. You talk a lot about letting go and the surrendering to joy. And what was the other book you wrote about was How Much Joy Can You Handle or something?
Oh, no. Well, I wrote How Much Joy Can You Stand?
Can you stand, yeah.
Some years ago, it was 99 and 2000 were the two edition dates on that. And then after I did Surrendering to Joy, I did another book called The Joy of Letting Go, because I realized what a focus letting go is for so many people. You know, again, and it's a collection of my experiences around letting go, just the way Surrendering to Joy was about letting go of Teal and grieving her death.
Well, you know, let's talk about letting go, because I, you know, I'm in several Facebook groups with parents, bereaved parents, and I hear often how people refuse to let go of their grief and their pain, because that means that they're letting go of their child. But what's all around that? You know, can you find joy by living like that?
No, you can't find joy by living like that. And what it is attempting to do is stay merged with that person through a dark or negative experience. I think the opportunity is to give yourself a chance to experience just letting go. And I think it's really frightening for a lot of grieving parents. If they believe the only way they can stay connected to their child is in grief, far be it for me to say you shouldn't do that, because that's what they feel capable of doing. However, there is an opportunity. You know, the phrase, and perhaps you've heard it, Janet, that I've heard around the loss of a child is you either become bitter or you become better. I made that decision the very first night. I was going to use this to improve my life. I was not going to use this to wreck my life. And, you know, I went to a grief group pretty early on for parents who'd lost children. And there was a couple there who'd lost their daughter 18 years earlier, and they were still angry about it and the way she died. And I just felt so much like the energy was getting sucked out of the room, you know, and it was dark. It was really dark. And I felt very bad for those folks, but I also felt like sometimes we have to live these things because we have to learn karmically. Our souls demand it. We are on a mission to evolve in whatever way we're going to evolve. And sometimes that means we have very confusing and dark experiences in our life from which we don't recover. I would say the opportunity is to make your own choice, you know?
It feels that way. But I wonder if, you know, that couple for 18 years of still being angry, maybe they couldn't see that choice. And like you just said, maybe that's their sole path to not see it.
And I doubt they would be listening to a show called Good Grief. Because really what I felt in that particular group was that there was a huge amount of agreement for them. And I was actually, when it was my turn to share, I said, well, I don't feel tremendous loss today. I feel like this is an evolution for my soul and her soul, and we're working together here, and something is going to come out of this. It's going to be better, even though I'm experiencing a great deal of sadness. And the person leading the group told me I was in denial. So it wasn't the group for me. Obviously.
It's not the group for you. No. Yeah, you're right. Those people won't be listening to a program called The Good Grief Conversation, because the decision that we make, that's what takes you on that journey. And you find the things that support the decision you are making, don't you? You know, it's like you get led. And like you, right in the early stages of Murray's accident, like within a day or two, I remember thinking, I must find the way back to happiness. Because I don't know if you know, I'm the author of a book called Happiness Millionaire. I was very much a happiness expert. I was on the radio talking.
I didn't know that about you. You're on the happy joy train, just like me. Oh my God, Janet. That's
and great. I got booted off it for a while, but also inspired by my son in a way. Do you know, I've never put this together until right this second. Murray, he loved the work that I did as a happiness expert. He loved the title of my book, Happiness Millionaire. And he regularly said, Mom, you need to do more of this. People need this message. And which is similar to Teal, what Teal was saying to you, you know. And then some crazy thing comes along and takes them. And what does it do? It brings us up and highlights the job that we must continue to do. That's our soul job. It's quite incredible. But these are things that you can't see. You're blinded to these things, aren't you? Because we're logic thinkers. We're busy looking at there's a certain pattern, a strategy. In fact, it was in your extremely busy woman's book, and you write about being a workaholic, and you say about, you know, dumping the strategy and stuff like that.
Right. Because I don't know, maybe I'm an older person. I'm in my early 60s now. And, you know, I have really learned it's not about the to-do list. It does not bring you happiness and joy. The happiness is the state of being. And it's, as you're saying, it's the choice that you make about what to do with the hard situations in life. It really is.
Yeah. I mean, my daughter, she started sewing. She never sewed before, but she started sewing and she's made some labels called the House of Murray. And so now she makes things that are beautiful. Like, and she puts these little labels in them. They're an honor to her brother. So every time she sews anything, she's with Murray. Murray is with her. And so I was really impressed with her for just finding that. And she just allowed that to be, you know, it was quite amazing. But I see so many people struggling that they're not opening up what could be and allowing that in.
Yes, yes. And I notice this, but I think it's a profound opportunity for them. And we have to stay out of it. We really have to stay out of it. I mean, I know, okay, we're self-help authors.
I know.
we're riding in on our horses to help, but we must allow people to move through these spaces of difficulty, because then if somebody else comes in and says, oh, no, no, do this, don't do that, they don't get the opportunity to evolve and grow. More than ever, I'm convinced that we have to have, you know, so-called bottoms in our life, times when we really bottom out. Because that's where our growth is exponential. And I am so much happier and so much more at peace. And if I may say, a little more evolved than I definitely was before Teal's death and before all the loss that I experienced. And I knew it was going to wind up here 10 years later. But I had to allow myself to just let go completely. And to those who are listening who have trouble letting go, I would say your opportunity is rich. Don't be afraid. Just know that you're on a path because you're supposed to be on that path, and that the opportunity is there if you choose to accept it. My dear pal Debbie says, loss will make you stronger, but only if you let it.
Well, you know, when you're saying like about there's opportunity, we often go in search of opportunity and feel we can create opportunity. But would you say that actually when you let go, because if you're letting go, that means you're not, you know, on your horse going creating anything because you've just let go. So would you say then it's in the letting go? How do you know there's an opportunity? How do you see it? I need answers. Come on.
You don't. You don't, Janet. You don't. Look, there's two ways to go. You can go on the structured, I'm going to get this thing done. I'm going to, you know, make something happen. And you will make something happen, inevitably. But perhaps the more powerful path is to let go, and you'll know when it's appropriate to do that. I'm not suggesting everybody go home, go into fetal position and suck your thumb for the rest of your life. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about choose your strategic moments to let go. For instance, I have written a memoir. It's taken me 7 years to write this book. It is the best thing I've ever written. And it is in the hand of a number of publishers right now with my wonderful agent. And I have no idea who, when, if, how this book will be published. But I also know that it's okay, whatever happens, because I was changed by writing it. And that's what I mean by letting go. I did the work because it was the work I was supposed to do. And I was so happy writing this book. I just felt so grounded, so in the prime of my writing. Just, you know, this is what I've been working for 40 years, this book. And I, of course, will publish it myself if it doesn't find a mainstream publisher. But the point is, it doesn't matter how the book gets out there, because the writing of it was already such a transformational experience. And I can let go. I don't have to, like, you know, spend hours and hours visualizing and, you know, rereading The Secret and, you know, doing all the things we might do to, like, push this baby over the finish line. You know, I think I could just trust the universe will take me where it needs to go.
Because don't you find, though, that no matter how much effort you put in like that, if something's not meant to work, it won't anyway. Something will.
Absolutely. You're so right. You're so right. Things will, you know, everything seeks to find its level, and it does.
And sometimes when you go so head on in like that, you actually miss what's going on around you as well. But we are conditioned to do that, though, especially when you read all the marketing stuff online.
You know, it's kind of fun to, you know, right now I'm playing with Instagram Reels. You know, it's fun to see what the new toys are out there and experiment with them and see how best to communicate with people. But I think achievement's a little overrated, to be honest with you. And I learned that from Thiel, who was the most unambitious person who ever lived, but one of the most joyful I ever met. And maybe she had it right, you know.
Look, we're out of time here at the moment, but let's continue this conversation in the podcast extras. I feel we're just getting warmed up, and we'll talk more about Joy, and we'll talk more about Thiel and her view on life and the things that she believed in as well.
Perfect.
Wow. Thank you so much to my guest, Suzanne Falter. That was a great conversation. I totally loved it. I'm still coming down from the conversation. You know, we went into doing more conversation in the podcast extras. So if you want to tune into that, then go to thegoodgriefconversation.com and just click on the listen to podcast extras, and then you'll be able to sign up for those. And you come and join our world, and I'm full of inspiring guests. And now that library of gifts in there is really building up. So there is something for everybody at whatever stage you are at in the grieving journey or just in life in general. You know, the whole thing I find very inspiring in the transition to life. So if you would like to connect with Suzanne, then her website is suzannefalter.com, and the Facebook group that she was referring to is the self-care group for extremely busy women. So you can go and sign up and join her over on Facebook. Of course, I'm going to put more links and things into the descriptions over on podcast extras and any show notes, things like that. So you'll be able to connect with her. So thank you so much for listening in. And this does conclude this season of the Good Grief Conversation. But we will be back in spring for our new format of 2 seasons per year of 12 weeks per season. I look forward to being back with you and speaking to you some more and bringing on some more absolutely amazing guests who I know are spreading their joy and their hope. And a Good Grief Conversation is a way for me to help them to do that so that they can reach you. In the meantime, you take great care of yourself. You may contact me over at the Good Grief Conversation. Come and join us on Facebook. We have our own Facebook group or on Instagram. So do come and join us. And you will always see inspiring things that appear on social media, so we are not going away. But we will be back with the conversation spring of this year. So should be like May time we will be back, but you will hear from it. In the meantime, don't forget you can join the podcast extras and benefit from all those amazing gifts that this season's guests have provided for you. As this is the final show now in series one of the Good Grief Conversation, I would like to say a very special thank you to John Medcalf, who does the editing for this programme, and to my good friend Teo Akinbody, who has written the music and played the music. Without both of those guys, I could not do what I have been doing. So I truly appreciate that. You've helped me to keep going and to maintain some great quality for the show. So thank you very much. So this has been a Happiness Millionaire production, and you have been listening to the Good Grief Conversation here on UK Health Radio. You can listen to UK Health Radio online, on the app, or just ask Alexa to play UK Health Radio. In the meantime, stay safe, stay happy, and I'll see you next season. Bye for now.